Henry's wife and widow, many years ago, established this memorial lecture in his memory to give us a platform on which to reflect on religion in America, Jewish and Christian. And over the years, we have had a distinguished list of invitees. Henry Rappaport was an attorney, a committed Jew who served as president of Temple Israel in White Plains and later as president of the United Synagogue. He was also a trustee of the seminary and a generous benefactor to many conservative causes. I am pleased this evening to welcome two of Henry's sons, David Rappaport and Michael Rappaport, and Joanne, Michael's wife, who are with us for this lecture. Rabbi David Wolpe is our speaker this evening, and I suspect that he has as large a fan club on the East Coast as he does on the West Coast. Many of us read his musings in the Jewish Week every week, and as one of his fans just said to me, it is the first column in the paper to which she turns every Friday. Rabbi Wolpe is going to speak this evening about what conservative Judaism has to offer the 21st century, and I suspect that the many students from the seminary and the many members of the rabbinical assembly who are here this evening are present because of the importance of the subject. The rest of us are here out of great respect for the speaker. As you well know, Rabbi Wolpe is the distinguished spiritual leader of Sinai Temple in Los Angeles, where he has served with vigor and vision and distinction for a good number of years. Before Rabbi Wolpe went to Los Angeles, he served here on the administration of the faculty for a number of years, and it was a period of time in which the two of us got to know each other very well. Rabbi Wolpe is a highly regarded public speaker who travels the country sharing of his spiritual insights and intellectual breadth. I would describe Rabbi Wolpe as an intellectual in the pulpit, a man who reads broadly, who writes and speaks English with great sensitivity and skill, and who thinks deeply about spiritual and ethical issues. I do not think that the Rappaport lecture could be better filled than with the presence of Rabbi David Wolpe. David, it is a great pleasure for me to welcome you back to the seminary.
Thank you, Chancellor Schorsch. It is a great pleasure for me to be back at the seminary. Although I live on the West Coast, I grew up in Philadelphia, and this is my kind of weather, as long as it doesn't rain. And it is it's wonderful to be here. I'm grateful to the Rappaports for making this possible. And what I decided to speak about, and has become more and more poignant, I think, as time goes on and more study is devoted to this topic, much of it coming out of the seminary, is the future of the conservative movement. And the reason that I want to speak about it is not because the conservative movement nationwide is in trouble, but because the conservative movement is important. If it were in trouble alone, it wouldn't merit speaking about. but in fact, I do believe, for reasons that I hope will become clear, that the conservative movement is central to Judaism, to religious Judaism, and to American Judaism, and that we suffer from a malady that is actually correctable if we would all just think a little less. I say this because I have had the interesting experience over the past couple of months in preparation for this talk of approaching conservative Jews, rabbis, rabbinical students, lay leaders, and also people on the periphery of the conservative movement, and I have asked them what seems to me ought to be a fairly simple question, and I ask it to you, and I'll be happy to give you a moment for you to answer it to yourself. The question is this: how, in a sentence, would you define the compelling ideology of conservative Judaism? The reason I ask the question the way I do, I'd like to parse the question for you, is first of all, it's got to be a sentence. I don't want paragraphs. I don't want books. I mean, I do want paragraphs and books. But any ideology that cannot be put in a sentence is very unlikely to move crowds of people. Ideologies that must be explained in a book, unlike, say, Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, or Torah Through Judaism, or Social Action, or any of 1,000 other slogans that in fact do move and motivate people, any ideology that has to be elaborated so that you have clauses and subclauses and paragraphs and semicolons galore, is an ideology that has a great appeal to the subtle, complex academic mind, but cannot in fact motivate a movement. And part of what we have seen in the conservative movement is that there are, certainly on the West Coast, and I know that this is true on the East Coast, there are passionate, active, emotionally moving, religious, conservative-trained rabbis and lay people who put together services and say, but we're not affiliated with any movement. When you say to them, what percentage of the people who are not affiliated with any movement grew up with or were trained conservative, they say 95%. But we're not part of any movement. And part of what any movement has to ask is, why would they dissociate themselves from us if, in fact, what they are expressing is what we are? And those are the questions that I want to try to answer tonight. Now, I warn you, although this warning may be superfluous, I'm from Los Angeles, so I don't have to say this, that what I'm going to say is slightly radical. But the reason that it's okay is tomorrow morning I'm getting on a plane. And if you disagree, the worst you can do is an email. But I want to begin by talking about what I understood conservative Judaism to be growing up, and also what I understood it to be being part of the seminary, training in a conservative institution, going through the UJ and Neve Shechter, and being part of a conservative synagogue. For many years, without realizing how to give it a finer point, when people used to ask me why I was a conservative Jew, I would give the following answer. I would say that I believed, I still believe this, that the essence of the people Israel is a continual dialogue with God. That's why we're here. Take out the people, take out God, take out dialogue, and there is no living Judaism left. And I said, what I understand about a dialogue is on the model of a friendship, which is, by the way, the term that the Midrash uses for God's relationship with Abraham. Ohavi, my friend. Not just my lover, but my friend. When you have a friendship with somebody, One of the things that you know is that you have a large range of shared references. You can say Colorado, and you both know exactly what you mean. You understand that we were in Colorado together 20 years ago and we did this, and I don't have to elaborate it all because you know we were together, that's part of the relationship. The Jewish people has that kind of past with God. You light Shabbos candles, God knows what you mean. We've been doing it for thousands of years. This is the instant recognition of relationship. But any relationship that lives only on what has been said is dead. If you think that the only thing you can do with your friend is elaborate on old memories, but you can't actually make new ones, you can't say something that has never been said before, then what you have is a fossilized relationship. And so I said, I'm a conservative Jew because I really believe in theory there is no reason why tomorrow there couldn't come to the seminary a scholar as great as the Rambam. I really believe it. Why not? Maybe it would be hard because, you know, television, internet, Game Boys, distractions. But in theory, someone should be able to be as revolutionary, as important in Judaism today as 1,000 years ago. I mean, after all, between Rabbi Akiva and the Rambam, there was no one like the Rambam, right? Nobody is influential. And in fact, what they used to say, as you know, is from Moses to Moses, there was no one like Moses. So if it took 2,200 years to get from the first Moses to the second, why could there not be in 1,000 years somebody who arises and could say, by the way, because this is part of being as important as the Rambam is wrong. Which is something that a certain branch of Judaism in regard to certain issues would never say. Because after all, who are we next to the Rambam? And I am perfectly willing to say, who am I next to the Rambam? I don't get to say in certain areas that the Rambam is wrong, but that's not because I live in 2005. It's just because I'm me. And that used to be, with variations and elaborations and a few bells and whistles, what I used to say when people asked why I was a conservative Jew. But lately I have thought more about it. And I have also realized how very powerful and sometimes painful it is to apply what conservative Judaism believes to the world. To speak about the results of historical scholarship, for example, publicly, where people have a hard time with it. And I wanted to come up with a different way of expressing the essence of conservative Judaism in a way that would be compelling to people who actually aren't going to take the courses that the seminary offers. What they're going to do is go to a conservative synagogue and ask their rabbi, so what is it that you believe? What is it that I believe? How do I express what I believe? The second step in getting to this was that I don't believe that God said, don't eat a cheeseburger. And by that I mean, not that anybody believes God said, don't eat a cheeseburger, I mean that the specifics of the commandments to me are the way in which the Jewish people have carried on their dialogue with God. I'll tell you what I mean. Right now we're talking English. You could say to me, you know what? Let's invent our own language. And we could invent our own language. But it would never be as rich, as expressive, as nuanced, as beautiful as English, because English has thousands of years of genius poured into it, right? Through all the language streams that fed it. And so we speak English, and the more English you speak, the broader the palette that you have to draw from in order to express things that are inside of you. The limits of my language, said Wittgenstein, are the limits of my world. In fact, the more words you have, the more you can say. I'll give you an example I used to give my students. The word velleity. Velleity means a little wish, something you want a little bit, not so much. Once you have the word, you have the idea. Right? When you say to somebody, I want an ice cream, but it's really a velleity. All of a sudden, you've expressed something because you have a word that you would not have expressed before. Halacha is a language. We can say things through halacha that we can't say in words because, after all, a lot of language is symbolism. It's not just words, right? We speak with our looks, with our gestures, we're Jews, right? With our entire bodies, and halacha is a way of speaking language to God that continues the dialogue. That's why language always grows and changes. Words come in, words go out. That's what happens to halacha. That's why I think of it as a path and not a law. Because law doesn't change the way language changes. All of this is background for a proposed, believe it or not, name change. I want to rename conservative Judaism. And I want to rename it in part because conservative Judaism is a pallid and uninspiring, and also, by the way, somewhat inaccurate name for the Judaism that conservative Jews practice. Among other things, most conservative Jews that I know are not so conservative. Right? They're just not. And the debates that conservative Jews have about conservative Jewish law don't touch them. I'll give you an example. Some of you are from the seminary and some of you aren't. So the two groups will hear this differently. There is still, in conservative Judaism, a debate among certain people about whether the tshuva, the responsum that allowed driving to synagogue, was a good thing or a bad thing. I have a synagogue where I get close to 1,000 people on a Shabbos morning. Of those 1,000 people, 985 of them drive. They've never read the tshuva. They don't pay attention to it. They think of themselves as conservative Jews. And the fact that people would still argue about whether it was a good thing or not, they would think of as ridiculous. Now, in what ridiculous? Yes. In what way? Absurd. Irrelevant. I don't want to be harsh. In what way do those of us who have studied here and argue about the tshuva and those people inhabit the same movement? In what way? In what way does the professor who says to me, which one once did, it's okay that they come, but you should let them know every Shabbos that what they're doing is wrong? In what way does that person share a universe of discourse with the people in my congregation? To call them both conservative Jews doesn't say anything. It doesn't tell me anything. They're not conserving, at least not conserving the way he's conserving. And also, by the way, there is a certain paradox inherent in the words conservative and movement. I mean, just, you know, if we're talking. And this is, by the way, this fondness for paradox, which is awfully good when it's in the writings of Chesterton, but not so good when you're trying to explain Judaism to people, comes when you get like the classic anthology of conservative Judaism edited by Mordechai Waxman, which is called Tradition and Change. So someone says, okay, what is it that motivates you? And you say, tradition and change. Now, tradition and change is a fascinating concept, but it's a paradox. And I want a slogan. You gotta have a slogan. And I said before to the Rappaports that I'm from LA, the land of simple marketing. But I want to tell you that simple marketing doesn't mean simple ideas. It means simple expression of ideas. Because without a simple expression of ideas, people will know that you're not talking to them. You're not. I would like to change, if I could, if I were given plenipotentiary power over the movement, conservative Judaism to covenantal Judaism. First of all, as I joked earlier with somebody, you don't have to change the luggage tags, right? Everything that's marked CJ can stay CJ. but also because conservative is not at the heart of the Jewish tradition, but covenant is. Covenant is the spine of the tradition. Covenant is what we're about. A bris, a covenant, that's what makes the Jewish people. You know, Solomon Schechter, who wrote the best essays in English on the Jewish tradition, despite the fact that English was not his first language, or even, I think, his second, despite that fact, but when it came to characterizing conservative Judaism, he uncharacteristically came up with just about the least felicitous coinage you could possibly imagine, the worst term. He called us Catholic Israel. Thanks a lot. As you can imagine, this didn't catch on. But what did he mean? And what has conservative Judaism always been a part of? Well, I'd like to describe three covenants that exist in our movement and in our world that conservative Judaism really does feel deeply about, that I think, by the way, are uniquely conservative in the way we feel about them, or I would say uniquely covenantal. The first is the covenant with God. And that I've already spoken about. That is, Judaism, covenantal Judaism, really does believe that the covenant is continuous, not diminishing. You know, the rabbinic idea that it came from Sinai and goes down and down and down and down, the decline of the generations, which is a classical Jewish idea, it violates what goes on in this place. There are a couple of professors here of Jewish studies tonight. They understand things about our tradition of which the Rambam had no idea. They know things about the Talmud Rambam knew nothing about. They know things about the rabbis Rambam knew nothing about. They know things about Sinai that Rambam knew nothing about. Am I going to say that they're diminished? No. Quite the opposite. We really do believe in the sacredness of study, and study is embracing, and that changes, deepens, continues our covenant with God. I really believe that. I think, even though it was controversial and people were upset about it, that the whole conversation about the Exodus and whether the Exodus happened was a good covenantal conversation. I really do. Didn't bother me at all. I said, actually, to someone afterwards, you know, I once read Winston Churchill was in the Boer War, and afterwards someone said to him, "How? What was it like to be in battle?" And he said, "It's exhilarating to be shot at without result." So as I was still in the same pulpit, and I looked around, I thought, it's not so bad. You know, you can actually say something. But it was a covenantal conversation because it was about the Jewish relationship to God and the way in which modern study and classical tradition interact or don't interact, whatever position you take. That's a good thing. That deepens one's understanding of the conversation. The second part of this is that we have a covenantal relationship with non-Jews. That's the covenant of Noah. It's the first covenant. It embraces all of humanity. And I understand my movement to take that seriously. We have Ruth Messenger coming this Shabbos to my synagogue. She's been there before. We're part of Jewish World Watch through the American Jewish World Service, which raises money and awareness and so on for the slaughter in Darfur. Why do we care? Because we take the covenantal relationship with the non-Jewish world seriously. We don't only care about ourselves. We don't only think that it matters what happens to Jews. You know, let me tell you an illuminating anecdote about this. Professor of mine from the University of Judaism has relatives, some relatives who live in Borough Park. So he once drove one of them to a wedding in Manhattan. And on the way back, and it's a long drive, he said from the beginning of the drive, "Do you have any questions of bitachon, of faith?" The guy said, "No." "Okay." So he drives and drives and drives, gets home, and as his cousin is getting out of the car, he says, "You know, I have one question. Why 1 billion Chinese?" Now understand what he was saying. He understands why there are French people in the world, because they affect the Jews. He knows why they're English, because even though we were kicked out for a while, we came back, they affect the Jews. But the Chinese, what does God need Chinese for? Right? They don't have anything to do with the Jewish people. And therefore, it's, by the way, and if you think this ideology is, you know, just ridiculous and dismissive, listen to what Rav Avadya Yosef said. Why did the hurricane hit New Orleans? Because they don't study Torah there. And because of what the Bush administration did with the pullout from Gush Katif. This is a very powerful ideology in the Jewish world that sees non-Jews only instrumentally. We don't have a covenant with them. They only matter in as much as they affect the way we behave and how we are in the world. And that's not covenantal Judaism. Covenantal Judaism believes, remember the first question. Forgive me, those of you who read this in the Jewish Week a few weeks ago. The first question in the Bible is what? What's the first question in the Bible? Ayeka. God says to Adam, where are you? The second question in the Bible is not a question from God to human beings. It's a question from human beings to God. When Cain says, Hashomer achi anochi, am I my brother's keeper? And the answer to the second question is the answer to the first. If you want to know where you are spiritually, I can tell you if you tell me whether you're your brother's keeper. And that idea, remember, Cain's not talking about Jews. He doesn't say, am I my Jewish brother's keeper? It's Hashomer Achi Anochi. That covenant is taken seriously in serious covenantal Judaism. And therefore, we have a responsibility to everybody who is in trouble, who is suffering, who is bereaved, who is bereft, who is alone. They're our responsibility, but they're not our first responsibility. Your first responsibility is the covenantal community of Jews. And that's the third covenant, or the second, depending on how you want to count it. And if that strikes you at first as being illiberal, let us say, right? Then all I can tell you is that you have been infected by a false universalism. You love your children more than your neighbor's children? I certainly hope so, for your children's sake. Everybody has a circle of love that gradually widens out. Everybody who's human does, anyway. And it's not only that there's nothing wrong with that, it's also that that is indispensable because somebody who cares equally for everyone cares for no one. Remember Mrs. Jellyby in Dickens' novel, who takes care of people far away but can't be bothered with her own kids? And everyone who reads that, there's nobody who reads Dickens' portrayal of her and thinks she's a good person. Nobody. It's like Mirabeau, the French revolutionary, who was called the friend of man. And when he grew up, his son said, the friend of man was friend of neither wife nor child. But that's your primary obligation, is to the circle around you. When I was teaching at Hunter College, when I was a student at the seminary, I had a student come up to me once and say, tomorrow there is a rally for Soviet Jewry and a rally against apartheid. And I want to go to the rally against apartheid. Can you give me a reason to go to the rally for Soviet Jewry? And I said, yes. The reason is, if you go to the rally for apartheid, who's going to go to the rally for Soviet Jewry? There is nothing wrong with cleaning your house before you clean your neighbors. There is something wrong with saying we have to be in perfect shape before we can help anybody else, right? That is a recipe for never helping anyone. But you do have a circle of obligations, and covenantal Judaism really does take seriously, and this is something else, by the way, that what used to be called conservative Judaism clearly does. I'm trying. Conservative Judaism has never given up on any community. That is, there are relationships with people on the right and relationships with people on the left. Not because we're in the middle, but because if you're covenantal, you're covenantal. You care about people even if they don't care about you. Right? The most powerful modern Jewish theologians, And I'm just going to name three. I mean, you can make an argument, but for the purposes of tonight, these are the most powerful because they help. I have to be honest. These are the ones that help my argument, therefore they are the most powerful modern Jewish theologians. If anybody disagrees, please see me after class. So, our Buber, whose concept of I-Thou is all about the idea that the central theological idea in the world is relationship. Right? The modern theologian Levinas, whose idea also is that the beginning of Jewish commitment is in the other, that is, in someone else, that when you look, you know, I said this earlier to those of you who were in the talk about leadership, that if you want to see an image of God in this world, what do? Look into the eyes of the person sitting next to you. And in that person's eyes, you'll see an image of God. And by the way, parentheses. Every time I have ever said that, and I've said it a bunch of times, the same thing happens, which is someone, and I won't point you out, you know who you are, somebody will look into the eyes of the person sitting next to them, and then they'll smile. And I want to tell you why you did that. I'd like to explain your behavior to you. It's chutzpahdik, but I will. It's because to look in someone else's eyes is actually very powerful. And you weren't ready for the power of the moment. And when you have an emotional experience and you don't want to feel it, what do? You make a joke. It's what Nietzsche said. Wit closes the coffin on an emotion. You feel something, it's uncomfortable, you smile, it's gone. But later on, when you're not sitting in a lecture, look in that person's eyes again and you will feel what Buber and Levinas and the Musar teachers were all saying, which is, you know, the beginning of fear of God is sometimes in the eyes of the person across from you. And, you know, I was going to say the third theologian, by the way, that I was going to talk about is Heschel. How does Heschel describe the Bible? He said it's God in search of man and man in search of God. And if you make his language egalitarian, you realize that human beings and God in search of one another is relationship. That's covenantal Judaism. That's what he was talking about. And that's what ought to be at the center of what it is that we teach, because it's at the center of who we are. This idea that the image of God is seen in the other person, and that we really believe that, and that means that the way you act towards other people, the way you act towards God, the way you build your relationship to God, that's what your Judaism is. If you say, my Judaism is a Judaism of relationship, I'm a covenantal Jew, that has a very different valence to my ear than if you say, my Judaism is a Judaism of questioning and complexity, I believe in tradition and change, I'm a conservative Jew. The second is a tremendous rationale for a classroom. But covenant is at the heart of the Torah. That's what it's about. Now, can you imagine for a minute, a little thought experiment, imagine for a minute that the energies and the intellect and the eloquence of the conservative movement and conservative scholars were turned to explore the covenantal idea in all its ramifications, which is practically as wide as Judaism. It would be, I think, a very different idea of a movement. Among other things, then you're not positioning yourself right, left, center, based on what you do, which is a foolish way to think about a movement. I don't do as much as him, but I do less than him. That's not a movement, right? That's like tacking against the wind in a sail, but it's not a movement. A movement is not, you know, you don't define yourself in opposition. You don't say, I am not you. You define yourself by who you are when you're an adult. Children define themselves in opposition, right? The first time that you realize you're I, you see that your parents are separate. But by the time you're grown up, you have to say who you are, what it is you do believe, not what it is you don't believe. Not what you're more than and less than. And I really do. I have discovered in the very short time, and I'm talking about 2 weeks, no more than that, that I have talked to people about the idea of covenantal Judaism, that the conservative Jews that I speak to say, well, of course, isn't that just Judaism? And my answer is, to you it is, because you're actually a covenantal Jew, even though you didn't know it. But there are crowds before whom I could talk about the covenantal relationship to non-Jews and they wouldn't recognize themselves in it. There are crowds to whom I would talk about the covenantal relationship to the Jewish people, no matter their political position, and they wouldn't recognize themselves in it. There are crowds to whom I could talk about the idea that your covenantal relationship with God means that it is continually growing and changing, and we shouldn't be afraid of that, and they wouldn't recognize themselves in it. What it means in practice, which is a really good question, that is, how does this translate to the way we live our lives? And although I have some inchoate, unformed thoughts about that, I would say that the answer really has to follow the exploration of the idea. That is, if you have covenantal Jews, then what you create are covenantal communities. And think about that for a minute. What is a covenantal community? And what obligations does it entail to be in a covenantal community? And what would a synagogue look like if it organized itself around the idea of a covenantal community? I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure that there is yet an answer to that. But I do know what a movement looks like when it can't enunciate its platform. It looks like us. Which is, you have a lot of learned, passionate, informed, dedicated people who have a hard time saying exactly what it is, in simple terms, that they promote in this world. And that's a shame. Since I want to have time for questions and comments and objections and brief alternate speeches, but we're all Jews. I had Joseph Epstein, the former head of the American Scholar, came to the synagogue not so long ago, and he said, when two Jews are in a conversation, one Jew is not listening, he's waiting. So I know what you're doing. He also, by the way, he had one other great line, before I get to my last story, I want to tell you the line just because it's such a good line. He said, I've known many wise Jews, but very few contented Jews. He said, after all, a sad Jew is a happy Jew, which I thought was also a... But not actually entirely true. But what is true is that we are resistant to change. I spoke about this earlier when I was talking about leadership to another group. People want change as long as you don't change that which they're attached to, right? People will come to you and they'll say, Rabbi, you got to overhaul the entire service. And then next week, the same person will come and say, you changed Adon Olam. What's with the different tune of Adon Olam? It's 30 years I've been hearing that tune of Adon Olam. And all of us are like that. All of us. We do want change. We know change is necessary, but we don't want change where it touches us. To do something like change the name of a movement, that's not a small thing. And it would actually overcome an enormous amount of resistance, especially among people who are describing us. Right? Even if you describe yourself one way, just remember how hard it is to get other people to look at you differently. It takes time. Anybody who's ever come home from college knows you feel different inside, parents treat you the same. Right? And that lasts for the rest of your life. But here's the story. It's told in the name of the Slonim Rebbe. He said, once there were two men who were walking in a dark forest, so dark they couldn't see the road, they couldn't see the trees, see nothing. And all of a sudden, along came very fast this beautiful, huge carriage that was filled with light. And inside, there were people, obviously aristocrats, who were dressed in beautiful dresses with jewels and elaborately done hair, handsome and beautiful, and they sped by. And one of the men said to the other, "Wow, did you look in that carriage? Did you see that? That was gorgeous." And the other one said, "No, I didn't see." He said, "Really? How could you have missed it? Didn't you look in the carriage?" And the second one said, "No, I didn't look in the carriage. I looked to see how the light from the carriage could illuminate the road ahead." Part of what makes it so difficult to see the road ahead is that our eyes are dazzled by what we see around us. And it makes it difficult to envision the not yet, what isn't here yet, what could be here. But it could be here. It just has to be sought. And in fact, even though I said I was going to end with that story, let me tell you one more and conclude with this. This is part of an exploration. I'm not pretending, even though I really think that this is something. I really do, and I believe in it. I'm not pretending that this is over. And I really do hope that this becomes the beginning of an inquiry. And so here's my final story. A very rich man, town in Eastern Europe, has a beautiful daughter, wants to get his daughter married off. So he goes to the local yeshiva, big yeshiva, and gathers all the students. And he says to them, "Okay, listen, all of you. I have a beautiful daughter. I'm a very rich man. I'm willing to marry my daughter to anybody who can answer the following question from the Talmud." And he propounds a question. So he sits there. The first day, all 5,000 students go by. None of them get it right. The next day goes in half and in half and in half. Gradually, day after day, the number diminishes. The last day, there are 3 students. First one comes up, gives him an answer. He says, "No, I'm sorry, you're wrong. Go away." Second one comes up, gives him an answer. He says, "Nope, that's not it. Go away." Third one comes up, gives him an answer. He says, "Nope, obviously there is no one here who deserves my daughter." Gets in the carriage, starts to ride away. One of the last 3 students comes running after the carriage, yelling and waving his arms. So the guy says, "Stop the carriage, stop the carriage." And he stops. And the student comes running up to him and he says, "Do you know the answer? Have you figured it out?" And the student says, "No, I don't know the answer. But before you go away, I have to know what the answer is." And the man says, "You're her husband." What he wanted was the need to have an answer. And what I'm saying is, there are a lot of Jews out there who need to have an answer, and that's a need that ought to be respected and not derided. What they want is not just complexity and questioning. They want an answer. And we owe it to them, not only because they need it, but because we have it. We have it. And all we have to do is say it in a way that Jews will understand, they will take to heart, and they will live by. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm more than happy to respond to any comments or questions you may have, so please feel free. Yes.
I think that's a great talk.
Thank you.
I'd like to raise one type of problem that I think your challenge comes up with, which is covenant is an exchange of promises.
That's an awfully good question already. All
right,
go ahead.
Yeah. So what I'm thinking of is, let's take 2 of your relationships. One is with God, and what about all the many conservative and other Jews who feel like, what am I getting back from God?
Yeah.
The other is the covenant with non-Jews. And many feel like, well, what am I getting back?
Okay, let me answer both. And actually, in some ways, both are the same answer. But as a rabbi, and by the way, all of you too, but I'm just going to speak from my own experience. I can't tell you how many Jews have come to me and said, why did God do this to me? Okay? Now, I want to tell you what never precedes that question. They never say, you know, Rabbi, I live in the richest country in the world, and I've never faced a famine. Why did God do that to me? You know, Rabbi, I have a mind that works. Why did God do that to me? You know, Rabbi, I had parents who raised me who were really good people. Why did God do that to me? The answer is, we've received an enormous amount from God. But We always tote God up on the debit scale. Always. And in fact, the attitude, remember the first, what is the first thing a Jew is supposed to say in the morning? Modeh ani lefanecha, I'm grateful to you. Shehechazarta bi nishmati, because you gave me my soul back in the morning. I woke up. Right? This is, you know, this is Heschel land. That's what Heschel used to say. Did you see the miracle? The sun rose this morning. That idea that God didn't give us anything back is, I don't want to dismiss the problem of evil by saying, after all, we got lots of stuff. The problem of evil is a real theological dilemma, and I don't want to pretend for a second that I, you know, flew out from L.A. to give you the answer. That thousands of years and millions of brilliant people have not been able to decisively answer. I mean, I have an answer that I use, but it's not to the point at the moment. Having said that, though, it is manifesting gratitude for people sitting in this room who, by virtue of the fact that you're sitting in this room, are in the 98th percentile of the luckiest people who ever lived, not just in the world, but whoever lived, to say, what did God ever do for me? I mean, from my point of view, did I get a good deal out of this covenant. I mean, I can't begin to express what a good deal I got out of this covenant. In terms of the non-Jewish world, much of the same is true. I mean, don't forget. You know, there's a rabbi in the Talmud who talks about how when bread comes to his table, all the things that were done for him in order to bring bread to the table. This world, all the wonders of this world, were not only made by Jews. I know we won all the Nobel Prizes. Okay.
I do get that all the time. It's like, enough already. Stop sending me how many Nobel Prizes you won on the internet, please. But and with all these other groups, see, they didn't win as many. But the non-Jewish world in specific relationship, hasn't always been easy.
But when you say we've not gotten any benefits from the non-Jewish world, that's absurd. Right? Not when you say. When one says. Because we live, look around you. Buildings and heat and air and cars and cities and governments. And we didn't invent America. We didn't invent America. America was, for the most part, I know, we had Chaim Solomon. God bless him. But America was, for the most part, a gift of the non-Jewish world to the Jews. Now, they didn't do it for us, but nonetheless. And then if you turn around and say, all sorts of terrible things happened to Jews. I mean, they turned boats away and they didn't take in immigrants. That's all true. It's all true. I'm not saying that covenant has been, all a bed of roses. But is there a covenant? Yeah, there's a covenant. Are there millions and millions of people all over the world who consider themselves friends of the Jewish people? Yes, there are. So we have to be more grateful to be able to express properly what the covenant means, I think. And not only say, because it wasn't all the way it should be, therefore there's no covenant. I think that both those things are true. So, yes.
If I find myself as a Torah true Jew, and I know what to do, I have to put out filler every morning. If I find myself as a social justice Jew, I don't have to march for Darfur. If I find myself as a covenantal Jew, the covenant is constantly evolving, what do I do?
Well, that's a wonderful question. It's a wonderful question. And the answer in part, I want to dodge it and then I want to answer it. But let me dodge it first. The dodge is, part of what I said at the end was, that's exactly what I'm looking for an elaboration of. How do you see halakha under the penumbra of covenantalism as opposed to command? Which, by the way, is a language, I must tell you, the language of command is a language that has less and less and less resonance among what we have heretofore been trained to call conservative Jews. I don't know how many verbal dances I'll have to do. I'm going to, Balanchine couldn't choreograph how I got to get around the name conservative Judaism. I would say, though, here is the question to ask that will, I believe, shape what you have to do, which is, in what way does this enhance, deepen, enrich the quality of my relationship? Halakha, remember, I spoke of as a language. A symbol system is a way that a while ago, I think, Neil Gilman called my attention to the fact that Louis Finkelstein once wrote about Judaism as a symbol system. Right? Halakha is a symbol system. There are halachot that clearly enhance my relationship bein adam lemakom, like putting on tefillin, right? You can argue it, but I would say so. There are other halachot that enhance my relationship bein adam lechavero, between one person and another, like tzedakah. So the answer is, the way you evaluate the Jewish way of being, the covenantal way of being, is what does this mean in terms of relationship? And I think you will find that conservative Jews tend to gravitate towards those mitzvot that actually speak to relationship in a way that, for example, Shatnez doesn't for most people. Why doesn't it? Because they don't see the relationship in Shatnez. They really don't. Shatnez is... everybody know? Okay. But they're all... And I can give you many different halachot, some of which speak more powerfully and some less powerfully to relationship, but that would be something we would work out, I would hope. Yeah.
Not that I'm a particular defender of shotness. but by using that example, you brought up, I think, an important question for me.
Okay.
Which is, no mitzvah necessarily encompasses all that we think is right and true.
Yes.
And good about Judaism. So the question is, how do you decide what in the panoply of mitzvot, if I decide the shatnez doesn't speak to the covenant,
right. Does
that mean I don't do it, I don't care about it? And if I say the same thing about tefillin, or if I say something...
Okay, this is the time, it's a great question, and thank you for asking it, and this is the time when we should turn the tape off. But we're not going, I know, I'm not really, but I'll tell you what I believe to be true, which is... It doesn't really matter what you prescribe. I will tell you what will happen. How many of you, you don't have to raise your hands, but how many of you don't even know what shatnez is? Right? It's not wearing wool and linen together, right? Like sowing two different kinds of seeds or yoking an ox and an ass. But that exact example points to what I'm saying. You know, when Schechter spoke about Catholic Israel, what he was saying is the organic community will in fact decide over time what it is that expresses our Judaism. And what I'm saying is the organic community will decide what expresses relationship. If I go in front of my congregation and I say, all the mitzvot are equal, you've got to observe all of them equally. Remember the lesson of the Nachash, of the snake, where he tries to make, you know, he says to Eve, you can't eat of any of the trees of the garden, tries to make God's prohibition so difficult that he'll destroy it. And what I'm saying is, you may not like the idea of prioritizing mitzvot, but out there in the world, everyone in our communities, everyone in the world, in the Jewish world, but especially everyone in our community, does prioritize mitzvot. They do say, you know what, the Passover Seder clearly speaks to me of my relationship to history, to God, to others, and so on and so forth. Shatnez, so much doesn't. I haven't, even though I'm the kind of person who attends a lecture at the seminary, I don't even know what it is. And so I would say, am I going to tell someone, therefore, you shouldn't practice it? No, of course not. But when I'm preaching what covenantal Judaism is about, it is about learning and doing those mitzvot that will deepen your relationship. And if I expend my rhetorical capital on saying, and don't forget, you have to get all of them, then what I have effectively done is destroyed the possibility of having a rationale for being Jewish. Because then the rationale is, you got to do everything. And that rationale has sailed. It's not why Jews are Jewish anymore, because God told them you got to do everything. Jews are Jewish because it expresses something deep inside of them, and because of what they believe in history, and because of their relationships. So my answer would be that if somebody in my community came to me and said, look, I can't do everything. Can you prioritize what I should do? My answer would be absolutely. Absolutely I can. Yeah.
If the marketing of conservative Judaism has been so poor, then how did it become the dominant form of American Judaism? Would you say that perhaps we've gotten off message, or
no,
that the consumer has changed?
Yes, number two. I don't think there... It's not as though... There was a message that we no longer speak. It is that, look, this is a question more of sociology than theology, but I will take a stab at it. the vast majority of Jews who came to conservative Judaism were raised in homes where observance was real, and they felt comfortable with observance. And it was, I would put it this way. My grandfather, Oliver Sholem, was a wonderful man, was not a religious Jew. But when they needed a minyan, they called him, because he was a native to Judaism. In fact, when I was here at the seminary taking senior homiletics with the late, great Simon Greenberg, he said to our class, your job as a rabbi is your principal job. Now, wait till you hear how he ended this sentence. This is amazing. To explain America to your congregants. Now, rabbis today don't have to explain America to their congregants, right? I happen to be a rare exception because about half of my congregation is Persian immigrants. So it turns out that Rabbi Greenberg had the last laugh. But most rabbis don't have to explain because we're natives. But we're immigrants to Judaism. My grandfather was a native to Judaism. Immigrants don't naturally fall into behavior patterns. Quite the opposite. Immigrants have to light Shabbos candles 50 times before it becomes natural. The first 50 times, they feel like somebody with a heavy accent trying to speak English. It takes a long time. Conservative Judaism was a perfect, undefined mass movement for people who were natives. We're not natives anymore. Immigrants need a reason to take the oath of citizenship. And what I'm saying is we got to give people now a reason, because that generation of natives raised a generation of immigrants for all the reasons we know. For all the reasons we know. There is almost not a time that I have given a lecture that somebody hasn't come up to me and said, gee, I wish I had raised my grandchild differently or my child differently or something like that. But we did. So now we have to find a rationale that our ancestors, grandparents, parents didn't have to find. Yeah.
Back to covenant and shotness.
Yes.
I'm in a loving covenantal relationship with my wife. There are certain things she asks of me that I don't understand. But I do them because she asks them of me, and I love her.
Right.
There's certain things that she asks me not to wear, and I don't get it. I don't wear them because we're in a covenantal relationship.
Yes.
And I love her, and she asks that of me. What's the difference?
Well, I would say there are two differences. One is, I would bet you that there are things your wife asked you that you say no. I'm sure. And when you don't understand something, you ask her why. And the same thing here. There are things, I suppose, that you could say that God asks of Jews that Jews don't understand. I mean, kashrut is a big one, right? Who understands what that's about? But you can understand its function in the relationship. In fact, before talking to a group, I talked about halacha and emptying the dishwasher. Okay? I empty the dishwasher at home. And I don't do it because my wife says, empty the dishwasher. I do it because it is an expression of the primary mitzvah of relationship. Because that's the mitzvah. What I almost, you know how Habakkuk, there's a midrash that, you know how. You shouldn't start any sentence with, you know how Habakkuk. Habakkuk. There's a rabbinic midrash where the 613 mitzvot gradually get whittled down to Habakkuk saying, the righteous shall live by faith. There's one commandment. What I would like to say is there's one mitzvah. The mitzvah is relationship. That's why we're here. Relationship. And relationship gets played out in a lot of specifics. And I agree with you, but as soon as you say your relationship with your wife has to get played out in every specific she asks you, that's a relationship that won't survive. It won't survive. And I'll give you, by the way, here's a really nice story that's tangential to this, but it's about emptying the dishwasher, sort of. And for those of you especially who are looking for a good story, Rabbi Grifter, who is a Rosh Hashiva, I don't know if he is still a Rosh Hashiva, maybe one of you know, but he was a well-known Rosh Hashiva. Once a couple came to him, and the wife said, my husband studies all day, and I want to know, he won't take the trash out. And I want you to find some rule in Judaism that will force him to take the trash out. So Grifter said, I'm sorry. I can't do it. She said, well, but he thinks it's beneath his dignity. Isn't there something that would prove? And Grifter said, there's nothing in Judaism that says your husband has to take the treasure. They go. The next morning, Grifter shows up at their house. The man opens the door and says, oh my God, Rob Grifter, I'm so honored to see you. Come in, let me feed you. He says, no, I'm here to take out the trash. The guy says, what do you mean you're here to take out the trash? And he said, it may be beneath your dignity, but it's not beneath mine. So that idea is that, you know, it's not the command. Now, he didn't take the trash out because he wasn't commanded to. But it is, in fact, the command of relationship that leads to the actions that make a relationship possible, the same as with a husband, wife, with friends, with brother, sister, parent, child, all those things. Yeah.
I'm a memorial student here at the seminary, and before I ask you my question, I just want to say that I've been saying this all night, that I wanted to hear the entire time that I'm a conservative Jew, and I hope I'm speaking for a lot of formerly conservative Jews. And young people like me who really want to hear what you have to say, and really appreciate it.
I appreciate that.
The thing I want to know is, and I'm starting to forget it when I'm talking, I want to know where you want to go from here. Because I'm hearing you talk, and you're very charismatic, and what you're saying is very moving. But as we know, to give a speech from a pulpit, and to talk to a crowd of people who get really enthusiastic about your work, which is wonderful and a great start, what's your impetus? Where are we going to go, and how can I get behind it?
First of all, thank you very much for that. And I want to say, this is not empty rhetoric. I can't imagine a better set of questions than the questions that I have been asked tonight, which is not, by the way, making this any easier. I started to write this up. I hope that, you know, given time and life and space and all of that, that I'll eventually turn this into, if not a book, at least a long article, something. How you create this kind of change is something that I don't entirely know, and I thought that actually the best way to start it would be to present it at the seminary. Because if it's going to happen, it's got to happen at least in part, or be cooperated with, or be accepted, or be looked at here. Because this is the place. You know? So the answer to your question is, I thought I would start it by doing this. But what the next step is, I don't entirely know, but I certainly invite people's suggestions. I mean, I intend to write about it, I intend to speak about it, but more than that, I don't know. Yes, Steve.
At a time when the reform movement is also speaking the language of covenant, peoplehood, tradition, but specifically eschewing the language of command and obligation, could you specify how would you distinguish, you know, your covenantal Judaism from liberal Judaism more generally?
Well, the first answer that I want to give you is no. Because I don't want to base what I say on what they're not saying. And I think that that's a trap that conservative Jews always fall into. I will tell you what I believe. I don't know, I don't actually know as well as you precisely what that language is. And if, I mean, someone said, by the way, from the other direction, someone said to me, well, Yitz Greenberg and David Hartman talk about covenant. And to which my answer was, that's why they're so well received in conservative synagogues. That's exactly why. I bet you that if you charted, right, there, I mean, because conservative Jews actually know this language and believe this language and live this language. And the only thing I would say is I really do believe in mitzvah, but I believe in the overarching mitzvah, which is the mitzvah of relationship. I think that is the commandment, and that is what we're obligated to do. Look, Moshe, I'm glad I remember this. I was almost going to forget this. What does it say about Moses? Here, Moses is the most important person in Jewish history. Does it say he did more mitzvahs than anyone? No. Does it even say Moses was the most ethical human being that ever lived? No. The highest praise that you can give someone is given to Moses. He saw God panim el panim, face to face. In other words, he attained the most comprehensive relationship with God. That's what it's about. If someone else wants to be part of this and speak this language, harei zeh mishubach, I think that's great. Let them become covenantal Jews too. Right? I'm all for that. But I don't want to spend my time. The only thing I will say is we deeply believe that relationship is enacted in the language of halakha. But and somebody who doesn't speak that language isn't part of the covenantal community that I'm talking about. Well, they're part of the larger covenantal community, but not part of covenantal Judaism that I'm talking about. But other than that, I don't know. I don't know. I think this may be one of those cases where there's enough, you know, overlap between various people who distinguish themselves in movements that, in fact, there's probably a broader circle than just one defined movement. Yeah.
I'm a rabbinical student. I want to thank you for coming here. I appreciate what you have to say. My main question is, you talked about the thriving tshuva and how people are going to thrive regardless of what's being discussed, whether it's good or bad. And I think that people, to use another example you use, the Seder, that people will do a Seder no matter what we say about the covenant. They might appreciate what we have to say about the covenantal relationship, but it's going to be a part of what they do. And my question is, you spoke a lot about getting, speaking on people's level and getting them to understand where you're coming from their level. And what I'm curious about is, you see the role of rabbis today as basically taking what people, things that people want, things that are in people's lives, and expanding upon them? Or do you see it more as challenging, bringing up new ideas, not challenging in a bad sense, not saying no to them, right? Like bringing up ideas they might not have.
I understand what you're saying.
Okay. Right.
So let me answer this and then one more question, because I just got a very subtle signal. Okay, that in a second, you'll be the last question. It was a big hook that was... No. The first thing that I would like to do is to frame people's understanding of what they're already doing. You know? I mean, look, I have an 8.5-year-old daughter. When she does something and I say, what you just did was very nice, that was a nice thing to do, it changes the deed and also changes the way she thinks about doing it again. Because sometimes maybe she just did it and she didn't know it was a nice thing to do. Now she knows it was a nice thing to do. When Ruth Messenger comes to the shul and I talk to people about Jewish World Watch, I'm going to tell them that this is part of the covenant. This is a covenantal action. It's a Jewish action. And that frames the idea of doing it differently in people's minds, right? To make it religious, Jewish, covenantal. So that's the first thing, is to let people know that what they're doing is in fact sacred, not just what they just happen to be sitting around the table. The second part of it is absolutely. I mean, what I said about, you know, that the more English we speak, the better we can communicate, the more covenantal language you speak, the deeper, richer is the covenant. Absolutely. And people are strong in different parts of it. But I don't know of any rabbi of any stripe or type who doesn't try to get people to speak more of the Jewish symbolic language. I mean, that's the essence of our task, is to get people to know more, to do more, to feel more, all those things which are, I would say, part of what it is to be in any growing relationship. So, yeah, last one.
So, I'm also a rabbinical student, and in our liturgy class yesterday, our seminar...
Is this a coincidence, or are there a lot of...
So, one of the things we talked about on an offhand side topic was that the Orthodox liturgy, in many ways, in the last 200 years, hasn't changed a heck of a lot. It's changed, but not as much. Whereas the Reformed liturgy has changed... All English, and now it's coming slowly, slowly. Each Seder they create every 5-10 years is a little bit different, a little more traditional. How do we make a covenantal community that stands the test of time?
The first thing that I would like to say is, you know, in my synagogue, we use Seder Sim Shalom, and we are awaiting with bated breath the new Machzor. Because we're still using the Silverman Machzor, whose English is too old for Chaucer to understand, and they really need some help. So I can't wait. And I actually think that the liturgical progress and work of this movement has been really admirable and praiseworthy. And, you know, if you look at Reuven Hammer's commentary on the Siddur Seim Shalom, that's also a wonderful piece of work. All those things. I'm a big fan of the way that this was done. Having said that, I think that it's impossible for Siddurim, and it's impossible historically, and there are people here who can speak to this much better than I can. Historically, Siddurim have always changed. You know, the best example is the Piyutim. I tell my congregation the only reason that the Machzor is 900 pages is because someone, thank God, invented binding. Right? Because if you hadn't bound the book, they'd still be sticking in Piyutim and making them mandatory. And you got to stand up and you got to open the ark because, you know, Yanai had another idea. So, I don't mean to be quite so impious, but the liturgical innovation is a natural expression of a living community. I think that the fly in the ointment, and this, I mean, this would take a whole nother evening to really discuss is Hebrew. We're not the first monolingual Jews, right? Already in the Talmud it says in Caesarea they had to recite the Shema in Greek. We're doing better than that, right? And Alexandria apparently wasn't so good either, but they're gone. But it's very, you know, it really Jewish prayer that doesn't have a Jewish language is I think unlikely to retain its flavor of Jewish prayer, and so and that's very hard because people don't learn languages in America in the 21st century, and I don't know. I mean, there are people who've thought about this and have better ideas about it than I do. I can't really give an answer, but I don't have a hard time with liturgical changes, with changes in the prayer book, with differences in commentary, with tinkering with the prayers, with adding this one, with leaving that one out, as long as, I would say, the skeleton and the basic integrity of the service is maintained, and that not because it is impossible to express those thoughts other ways, but because in order to create any kind of organic community, you have to have a continuous tradition, I think, and a continuous liturgical tradition is at the heart of what it means to be a Jew, and also because it really is terribly important for a Jewish person to be able to walk into any shul and be able to pray. And you can't do that if you don't learn to pray in Hebrew. Now, you may not be comfortable in that synagogue, but at least you can be more or less a part of it if you're able to pray in Hebrew. And once you lose that, you lose something really irreplaceable in terms of being part of a community. And it's kind of ironic that now that we have Israel, you know, now we're losing Hebrew. Before, when there was no Israel, people could pray in Hebrew. Now that we have a land of Hebrew, and there probably are reasons for that as well, but we'll leave that for the moment. Having said that, I guess that I would close just by saying this, which is, I don't want to pretend, although I have all evening, that I have all the answers to this. The question about liturgy is a good one, right? If anybody parsed my answer, if you put it on a transcript and read it, you know, it would probably not amaze you with the leaps of logic. But the feeling that we have a positive lapidary, that is clear-cut and clearly expressed message, it's not only important for conservatives, it's important for any religious person. If you find any deeply religious person and you say to them, tell me in a sentence what you believe, any of them are able to say it. Any of them are able to say it. And even though if you push them, they may then complicate their belief, affirmation comes before complication. You don't start with complications. You start with affirmation, and it's time we did. Thank you.
Rabbi Wolpe, I think you affirmed us all. You have written often about the need for passion. You embodied this evening what you have spoken about, that is passion. And nothing ignites an audience like passion. I should also like to observe, Rabbi Wolpe, that you have used us as a laboratory, and I couldn't think of a better laboratory for your ideas. You've challenged us. We will continue this dialogue here at the seminary and beyond, and I think you have sown some very important seeds here. So I want you to appreciate just how deeply we are grateful to you for coming here and for giving the best of your thought, and we wish you well in the weeks and years ahead as you continue to deepen your thinking about covenant. Thank you, and thank you all for coming.